AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
On the Empire Podcast this week, what's that, Lassie? The church roof has been broken. Well, thankfully, we've got a Christian Slater in town. Yes, he's here to talk about his new TV show, Mr. Robot, plus all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that just put a fiver on someone to win this year's Apprentice. You know who it is? It's the old bearded guy who keeps pointing his finger at everyone. I've got a feeling about him. A really good feeling. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, sponsored by O2's Go Think Big, which brings you valuable career advice, amazing insider contacts, and exclusive tips to set you up for your dream career. Be sure to check out gothinkbig.co.uk for online tools, features, and one-of-a-kind work experience opportunities, including with Empire. Dum, 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 dum. Right now, Go Think Big are giving any young budding film director the chance to win a starter kit worth £5,000, including a Canon EOS 5D Mark III camera, which is very, very nice, and an Apple MacBook, which is also very, very nice, complete with editing software, which is also very, very nice. Again, to find out more, head over to gothinkbig.co.uk. As usual, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning who also, as chance would have it, applied for this year's Apprentice. And I have, weirdly, their application forms right in front of me. See if you can guess who's who. I'm a real dragon in the boardroom, says this contestant. When it comes to business, I do whatever it takes to win, Chester. Sam and Dean with no shirts on. That last bit didn't even make any sense, Helen O'Hara. What's going on?
How did you know? This is, of course, a complete lie, Chris. As you know, I applied for Dragon's Den.
Oh,
I mean, come on.
It's obvious, isn't
it? It's obvious.
Well, I'm out. Let's see if you can guess who the next person is. I'm quoting directly from their application form. As a massive West Wing fan, my business strategy is to sit around in my pants all day rewatching my West Wing box set. When it wears out, I intend to open a business long enough to make enough money so I can buy a new West Wing box set and maybe some new pants. It's James Dyer.
Literally, the only time you're only ever going to introduce me is something to do with the West Wing, aren't you?
That's, well, you need to be more interesting.
This is why Phil does the podcast, because he's just more fun to make fun of.
No, you should see Phil's face now. When I do, when I introduce him as the art house guru, it's like a piece of him dies inside each time.
Well, we should do it now, because Phil, unfortunately, can't do the podcast this week because he's in Japan, because his Kurosawa box set marathon has gone method. He's reenacting every single one of Akira's films in Japan, starting with Hidden Fortress. So that's good.
Has anyone ever actually called Akira Kurosawa Akira before?
We are on first name terms. My Xbox gamertag is Yojimbo.
So it is Yojimbo.
And when Sam used to work here, his Xbox gamertag was Samjuro.
There you go.
There you go. It's
hot beautiful.
Pretty amazing. All right, we don't have a lot of time. We've got a lot of ranting to do, James, you and I, about something in particular. So let's get on with this nonsense. Here is a question. It's been sent in via Twitter by @EwanFranklin, who says, in the wake of that incredible scene in Sicario, what are the best movie scenes set at the dinner table?
Oh.
This is kind of like a dinner table right now.
I'm underfed this morning, so this is actually making me hungry.
I'm so currently eating a cinnamon bun that was bought for me today by Helen because someone, I'm not going to name any names, was half an hour late for the recording. So we had lots of time to kill. And Helen bought me something because Helen was here and I was here. See if you can use via process of elimination who wasn't here. But anyway, thanks, Helen. This is really tasty.
I should be late every time. There's an alarming amount of pastry in the pod booth. And there's yum-yums. There's also weird neon pink mood lighting, which is strange.
But very atmospheric. Back to the question for a second.
Oh, yeah.
This is an interesting one because a lot of directors talk about how hard it is to do a dinner table scene. I remember, for some reason, Joe Wright talking about Pride and Prejudice, and his first day of shooting, basically, on his, by that point, by far his biggest project to date, was Judi Dench and a dinner table scene. So he was absolutely, I think it's fair to say, terrified. We'll come back to him when we get to Pan later. And yet, despite the fact that they're difficult to do, they keep cropping up because they're a great way to get literally everybody round a table.
Absolutely. Well, there's so much coverage, isn't it? And everyone's doing stuff, and so it's hard to keep track of continuity, and it's hard to keep track of angles and where everyone's looking. So that's why it's tricky.
Definitely. One of my favourites has got to be Beauty and the Beast, where they, you know, dispense with the numerous people around the table and just have the flatware come to life, which is far easier and quicker. The Be Our Guest song is one of the great moments, well, I think,
is
in,
a
that,
good song.
In that film.
I was about to say sung that many times. I've never sung that song, but I've listened to it many times.
Depends what you define by dinner, doesn't it, really? Reservoir Dogs starts with a great scene. Guys around the table.
Yep.
Is it a dinner table?
No.
It's a diner table.
It's a diner table.
Isn't it breakfast?
And then technically they've just had breakfast. Am I disqualifying that from the running?
Well, if we're having restaurants, then you've got to have the Salazzo McCluskey scene from Godfather.
This is true. And you got to have heat. But that's two guys having coffee. Yes, they're not eating any.
I mean, maybe they did after the scene ends. Maybe we just didn't see that bit.
Yeah, we never see what happens. I've always wondered what happens in the aftermath of that scene. When Macaulay and Hannah, like, do they do that really embarrassing thing where they say goodbye and then end up going in the same direction? It's like, oh, you again. Oh, hello. And then they walk to each other's cars and it just gets a little bit annoying.
Well, this is me.
do you want to come in? No. Okay. Well, sure. just a coffee.
It's a very different take on heat, Chris.
Bringing the conversation back to monkey brains. Temple of Doom, I'm going to throw out there.
I think you may have won.
Yeah, I think you probably have.
I think you've just thrown down one. That's pretty good. You can drop the bat and run away like that guy did in baseball last night.
Indeed.
Topical references. What happens in the, for people who haven't seen Temple of Doom, James?
They eat lots and lots of very appetizing things, many of which look like they've been served in the staff cafeteria, including monkey brains and eyeballs and something involving a goat skull.
And snake surprise. Don't forget snake surprise.
What's
for dessert.
A surprise?
More snakes!
Just your average Angus steakhouse, really, isn't it? It's Helen, as our lawyer.
No.
I've looked in the glass window, Helen. I've looked in there, and frankly, that's what I saw.
I ate there once.
You ate at an Angus steak?
Yeah, when I first arrived in London.
This is what everyone does when they get off the boat.
It was my birthday, and I only had a few friends, and we all went to Angus Steakhouse because I went, damn it, I want a steak on my birthday. And the experience was so bad, so awful, that A, I've never been there since, and B, I was so angry and depressed on my birthday that I went out and immediately spent money I did not have on a PlayStation 2.
In fairness, Chris, you would have done that after a good meal as well.
I don't know if I would, Helen. Basically, I was so angry, and we were walking around Oxford Street. It was like quite late at night, and Game was open, which was a bit of a sign. And I went, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to do this because I've been toying with it for ages. Went in, bought it, enjoyed it. Next week, price came down by 100 quid. Let that be a lesson to you, kids. Do not go to an Angus Steakhouse. Other steakhouses are available.
That is one of the great anecdotes.
And we should also point out that Angus Steakhouse, it might be really, really nice.
It could have come a long way since then.
It could have come a long way.
Aberdeen Steakhouse, for example.
Indeed.
Let's roll up a few more. The whole of The Last Supper. Chuck that out there. The entire film. Meet the Parents.
Yes.
You can milk anything with nipples.
Can you milk? Never mind.
I have nipples, Greg. Can you milk me?
I feel like in Phil's absence, somebody should say Babette's Feast. All those kind of films.
Yes.
So let's just assume that he was here and said all of those. Yeah. Shall we?
I should also mention pretty much every single Ben Wheatley film. There is an excruciating scene set around a dinner table. Not so much Field in England and High Rise.
There is one in High Rise.
Yeah, sort of. Kind of. And my favourite of his, he uses dinner tables as a way to expose all the seething hatred underneath that people store underneath the surface. My favourite one of those is towards the end of Side Series, where it's around one of those little toy dining tables, which is really, really fun.
I like that one a lot.
Any others?
American Beauty's Past the Fucking Asparagus. That's a pretty good one. Banana Boat Song of Beetlejuice is a personal favourite.
Deo.
Deo. Do we want to go a bit left field? Hannibal, Ray Liotta's Brains?
I just hate that film too much to talk about it.
I'm going to close with Taken, because it's always good when you shoot someone's wife at a dinner table.
Ooh.
Note to
is
self.
Is it? I'm not sure it is.
When Liam Neeson does it, it's okay.
When Liam Neeson does it, it's expected. Yeah. Now, if I invited Liam Neeson around my house and he didn't shoot my wife in the arm, I'd be disappointed. I'd have to ask him to leave.
And rightly so.
I mean, I feel like asking him to leave should probably come up in either scenario then. But okay, I think we've answered that question and then some.
Back to the Future as well has a cracking scene sent around the dinner table, which packs in a lot of scene-setting exposition, which comes to play later on. So that's a good one. True. As well. And again, as always, we're not trying to be exhaustive here or comprehensive. There are stuff we're missing, obviously. Do send them in via Twitter. For example, last week, we missed loads of musical sequences in non-musical films. People were pointing out Shaun of the Dead and all sorts of stuff this week. You're absolutely right, but thank you for sending them in. And we'll try and read out the best on next week's podcast.
They also last week solved the Tom Hardy duck dilemma. Would you rather fight 50 duck-sized Tom Hardys or one Tom Hardy-sized duck? Mm-hmm. The answer is, of course, that people would rather fight one duck-faced Tom Hardy. Mm-hmm. And then link to one of his pictures from his old MySpace profile.
Oh, God.
So that squared.
We're no closer, though, to solving the question of which would be tastier. But perhaps another time.
Crispy fried Tom Hardy.
Absolutely.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah, a bit of cucumber, a bit of hoisin sauce.
Shredded in a half pancake.
This has become a very
Tom
different
Hardy.
Dinner party.
It's a culinary podcast this week.
Okay, that's that for that question. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast and treat it with respect and reverence, do send them in via Twitter. At Empire Magazine is our Twitter handle. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it, but other Empire Podcasts will probably see it instead, and they'll read it out in their show, and there'll be all sorts of comedic confusion. You can Facebook us, we're Empire Magazine, and you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. We had a couple of good email questions in recently, so I may give those a whirl next week. It's time for some movie news, otherwise known as I get angry and rant at things.
Shall we start with the one that's going to get you angriest and then try and soothe the raging beast?
I don't know. Do you want to go the other way around? Should we start with the happy stuff and
let's ramp up.
All right. Happy stuff. A rumor story. Let's sound the rumor klaxon quite a lot. There is a rumor that Hulk, Mark Ruffalo's Hulk, will appear in Thor Ragnarok.
What?
This is happy stuff. Happy. Marvel, Chris.
Hang on. I just have to take my objectivity and sit it to one side, get my fanboy hat on. Yes, I'm on board with this.
Spoiler here for anyone who hasn't seen Avengers Age of Ultron, although I don't understand why you're listening to this podcast if not. But we, of course, last saw the Hulk disappearing off in a Quinjet. There was some suggestion he may have leapt out somewhere in the South Indian Ocean or Southern Pacific. But what if he didn't? What if he went into space and found himself fighting alongside Thor as he tries to stave off the Asgardian apocalypse and probably more trouble, we're assuming, from Loki and probably something else? There's another rumor that there's going to be an other planet involved, which could tie into the whole sort of Planet Hulk storyline. Again, we're getting into wild speculation with
Speculation. I think the thing with the Planet Hulk, I think the internet, the fanboy community, has been trying desperately to make Marvel do Planet Hulk. I'm not a fan of the Planet Hulk storyline. I'd be quite happy if they just did not touch it.
I quite enjoyed bits of it. I have to say, I was just rereading it recently.
Well, one of the problems with Planet Hulk is that it removes Banner from the equation. One of the joys of the Marvel Cinematic Universe iteration of Bruce Banner is Mark Ruffalo, and you want Ruffalo on screen almost as much. In fact, I want it as much as you want the big green guy. I'd be quite happy if they avoided Planet Hulk. We should stick a big flag. We've already mentioned the rumor klaxon, but I would take this with a big pinch of salt at the moment.
I think like a whole salt cellar would probably be more appropriate.
It's worth pointing out also, Planet Hulk is really only interesting because it's a preface to World War Hulk, which is a hell of a lot more interesting.
And also a great title. That's one of the great comic book titles. I want something called World War Hulk. I don't even care what's in it. Like, they could just then have him sit around and read a newspaper and I'd still be happy.
My favourite internet meme from that era was when Civil War was going on in the comics and everyone's going, who's going to win? It's going to be Iron Man, it's going to be Captain America. And there was a GIF going around on the forums just said, it doesn't matter, you're all fucked when the Hulk gets back. And that summed it up for me.
I actually really like World War Hulk because I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Hulk fan, as I think regular listeners of the podcast will know very much. When it comes to top Trumps, I like the idea that, you know, he is the strongest one there is. Blah, blah, blah. That's what I like about World War Hulk. It really uncorks a Hulk's potential, and he really just does visit an extraordinary amount of pain on heavy hitters that Earth has to offer.
Yeah. We should just, to kind of round up the Ragnarok stories this week, obviously Taika Waititi is down to direct, which is fascinating and I think very good choice. Even though he's known for comedy, though, I've heard rumours it's going to be quite dark. So who knows? I don't know. Maybe you need a comic director in that case to kind of lighten things up if your plot line's quite dark. I don't know. The other interesting rumour involves the lovely Rebecca Ferguson of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. The rumour has it that she might be up for Valkyrie, as in not the Tom Cruise film, but the Marvel character.
They're remaking Tom Cruise films with people who've been in Tom Cruise films.
That's
Remind
right.
me who Valkyrie is as a character.
She's another Asgardian superheroine.
She was a member of the Defenders for a while as well. You know, proper sort of imagine like a good Red Sonja.
Yeah, skimpy armor, that kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, everybody knows if you cover your stomach with your armor, it takes away your strength. It's like cutting Samson's hair. Why would you do that? It's crazy.
Tangent. tangentially related to the Hulk Ruffalo thing. Did anyone see the New York Comic Con pictures of Jared Leto and Mark Ruffalo, who turned up cosplaying and walked among the masses? Jared Leto, who dressed as some kind of baboon, posing with someone in full makeup as his Joker. Quite cool.
Yeah, that was awesome, actually.
He tweeted he had no idea, which is a lot of fun.
I'm convinced we've probably talked to some people at Comic Con, some famous people. I certainly went around the floor a couple of years that I've been there, taking pictures of all the best costumes. I wasn't in costume. All the people I was taking pictures of were. And although I do now have a Wonder Woman costume, so I could do next year, I got some pictures of great people. And I wonder now, were they all famous or just like half of them?
Well, Cranston did it as Heisenberg, didn't he? And John Boyega did it as a clone trooper at Celebration.
Yeah. Next year at Comic Con, I'll go as you. You go as me. Helen, go as Phil. Phil will go as Helen. Actually, no, I'll go as Helen. Sounds more fun. Yeah, let's do that.
We'll just
cosplay as people who no one would ever want to cosplay as. Fingers crossed that they use Hulk a bit more in the MCU.
But yeah,
Thor can always go back to Earth and get him and bring him back again. I don't think that he went into space at the end of Avengers 2.
I'm excited to see it either way.
Now, can we get angry about something?
You ready? Let's get a little bit angry then. Robert Rodriguez is on to direct Battle Angel Alita. James Cameron has been talking about this film for approximately 75 years. He is now, however, a little bit tied up with the small matter of 3 Avatar sequels and has decided that he's not willing to wait another 75 years to make it, and therefore is apparently handing the directorial reins to Robert Rodriguez, who is currently in negotiations. This is not yet fixed. How do we feel?
I'm disappointed, but not because I have a sort of dying love for Battle Angel. In fact, I'm not wildly familiar with it. I've read up on it when Cameron was doing it. It's more that it's a shame to me that Cameron's not doing something else. I think this kind of marks to me his commitment to only do vegan projects from now on and to make films about carob bars.
You wouldn't see him in an Angus steakhouse.
Well, no, you wouldn't. And I think that's a bit sad. And much as I enjoyed Avatar, I don't really want to see another 8 of them. I think it's a shame in that regard. As for Rodriguez taking it on, I mean, you know, go nuts.
I feel like it's been a little while since he knocked it out of the park for me, I'll be honest.
Yeah, Dust Till Dawn, I think, was pretty much it, wasn't it?
So I think we've said this in the podcast before, that he's a really frustrating director, Robert Rodriguez, because he's got loads of talent. I'm not sure that he's utilised it to the best of his ability. Maybe taking on someone else's project. Again, like James, this is a property I know very little about. Exciting, I guess, the idea of James Cameron doing it. Robert Rodriguez, for all his talent, seems to be several steps down on the ladder, but it'll be good maybe to get him away from some of the stuff he's been doing recently.
Yeah.
And maybe fulfill the potential that I think remains sadly unfulfilled.
I'll be interested to see what he does with a female lead, certainly in his last few years, partly because he's been dabbling with a grindhousey, noir-y feel. His female characters have not been the most inspirational, I think it's fair to say.
Santanico Pandemonium is nothing if not inspirational.
That was many years ago for a start. If you look at like Machete and Sin City and so on, the image is a little bit less clear, I feel. You want to get a little bit angrier? Are we ramping up?
Chris is going slightly green.
Okay. There's a little greenish tinge there around the edges. He is wearing, I can confirm, his Hulk purple jumper.
Yes, you are.
I am.
So that's appropriate.
And no pants. Actually, I just wanted to let you know that.
But speaking of the strongest one there is...
It's not true. I've got pants.
Warner Brothers has announced Godzilla versus King Kong for 2020. Legendary Pictures obviously made the last one. They're also working to make Kong Skull Island, obviously, at the moment. But they now have a whole plan in place. Kong Skull Island will now be out on March 10th, 2017, a Godzilla sequel in June 2018, and Godzilla vs. Kong in 2020.
This is one of those things. It's a bit like going over a waterfall, isn't it? You see the drop coming and yet you go towards it with a tedious and fatal inevitability. I think when they sort of announced Skull Island at Comic-Con that time with the legendary panel, you know, right after the Godzilla thing, we all saw this coming and yet we hoped beyond hope that perhaps it, you know, wouldn't. And here we are.
How big is King Kong in this version of events?
That's an interesting question because he doesn't strike me as Godzilla-sized.
No.
Well, he's usually about, what, 25, 30 feet?
Yeah.
He's a toothpick for Godzilla.
Yeah.
There's no versus there. Yeah, what can they do? Can they team up? Yeah, hey, cuddly little mite. He's basically a tick. You get these birds that land on rhinos' backs and they pick out all the ticks in between the scales of the rhino's armor. That's what King Kong is to Godzilla. You know, beat around the bush. He's 300 feet tall, can breathe fire and destroy a skyscraper with his tail. Oh, and he breathes fire when he remembers that he can breathe fire, which is always conveniently at the end of a movie. But I don't know.
It's like a dinosaur versus a baby chimpanzee.
It is.
Godzilla's a giant fusion reactor the size of a skyscraper, and King Kong hangs off the top of one.
Unless King Kong becomes a hemorrhoid.
Ew.
And inserts himself.
No, stop.
Maybe.
I'm spitballing here.
It's going to be Army of Darkness. It'll be like Ash versus Mini Ash.
Maybe it'll be like Monty Python, and King Kong will basically run around going, I'll bite your legs off. Maybe.
Tis but a scratch. First 5 minutes, though, King Kong gets absolutely flattened and Godzilla has no idea he's done it.
But, I mean, we're obviously being silly, but there's a serious point here in that there is a serious imbalance there. That, how does that work unless they level the
Well, field? It's not just that serious imbalance. One of the criticisms of Godzilla that came out a few years ago was that you could take the human characters out of the movie completely and it would affect the plot not one iota. Apart from that slight business towards the end with the nuclear bomb where Aaron Taylor-Johnson sells it off. You know, oh, spoilers. That's a worry here. So, for example, if Tom Hiddleston carries over from Skull Island to this, I'm just spitballing, or anyone carries over from Godzilla 2 to this, how do you make them matter in a plot like this? Where you already have a giant monkey that could squash you, then you have a giant lizard that could squash a giant monkey that could squash you. It's like, how do you make those characters have some sort of impact on the story? That worries me, but my anger isn't about that. My anger is about, and I've said this before in the podcast, that you're putting the cart before the horse here massively, to a massive extent. We haven't even seen Kong Skull Island. We haven't even seen Godzilla 2. And the first Godzilla film, I don't think, was that well-liked. And it just about made enough money to garner a sequel. And so you're already saying that no matter what happens in 2020, we're going to have Kong versus Godzilla?
Well, it's not no matter what happens, is it? Because we've seen a few times now that these plans do not necessarily pay off if the first film doesn't. But, you know, maybe you as film fans should just stop listening to these kind of announcements because they're for shareholders. These aren't for film fans, really.
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know.
I think we can all lay the blame for this firmly at the feet of Kevin Feige. Because if he hadn't done such a good job with Marvel, people wouldn't feel the need to link up every single property that springs to mind. I mean, we're literally 3 months away from a Batman versus Superman versus Godzilla versus the Wolfman versus Dracula announcement.
No, that
actually,
that
sounds good.
Except that a lot of people would still think that Batman would win. I mean, the number of people who genuinely believe in a no-holds-barred fight that Batman would beat Superman. Yeah. This is a genuinely cherished belief for so many people.
Batman versus Godzilla? Batman.
They genuinely would.
This is so, we discussed this the other day, that we won't discuss the context, but you had a conversation with someone, didn't you?
Yes.
Which essentially ended in, if not physical conflict, almost tears, because you said, obviously, Superman would win in a fight because he's a godlike alien and Batman is a rich dude with ears on his head.
Yeah.
But no, they will not accept that.
The point is,
we're going to get letters.
Who
about
wins
this
in
week?
A fight between Batman and Superman? Who wins in a fight between Batman and Godzilla? Who wins in a fight between Batman and Dracula? The answer in all cases is the Hulk. I think we can all agree that and move on. But yeah, it's a very good point that it may not happen. And of course, we don't want Godzilla 2 to be bad. We don't want Kong Skull Island to be bad. No. We want those films to be good so that in 2020, when King Kong versus Godzilla rolls around, that we're actually looking forward to it. We're excited by the possibilities of it. But someone on my Twitter feed, a guy called Graham Patrick last night, who I think listens to the podcast, hello Graham, said, I'm sick of being told what I'm going to see in 5 years' time. And that is a byproduct of Marvel's success, absolutely. But I don't think they can be held responsible for other studios copying their model and not doing it as well. That's angry part one.
So fingers crossed. Let's move on to angry part two, so much angrier. And that involves a Die Hard origin story. So given that A Good Day to Die Hard didn't do so terribly well, it did okay worldwide. The numbers are still there because everybody loves Die Hard, but it was pretty poorly ranked with critics. And frankly, it doesn't have a lot of love for the franchise now. So 20th Century Fox now want to go in a new direction for the sixth installment. They want to go prequel. They want to go young John McClane. They're looking for a writer right now to hash out the idea, which would have Bruce Willis return as present day McClane in like a bookend story, but then take us back to the 1970s where he would be a New York beat cop.
This is young John. This is born hard.
And this is, we should mention, this is not even a rumor. This is something that's actually happening. Len Wiseman is going to direct it with Lorenzo Di Bonaventura. He's going to produce it. They're going out to writers right now. And Len Wiseman today, just to confirm that we hadn't all dreamt it, tweeted a picture of the logo, Die Hard Year One. That's what they're looking at going to call it.
See, now, you will know that I have a theology degree. And when I got up this morning, I checked because I wasn't entirely sure. And I looked at the book of Revelation. And it is, in fact, a passage that Lowe and Len Wiseman came under 20th century
Len
Fox.
Wiseman.
Wiseman. Well, it's biblical times. They pronounce things differently. He came under 20th century Fox and did give birth to an abomination. And the number of the beast was 666.
That's weird because I opened my Bible today and there was a picture of the logo for Die Hard Year One where that chapter was. I don't know. I think we may have peaked too much by comparing this to an episode of the book of Revelation.
It's the end of days, and it's actually going to be worse than End of Days.
There are so many things wrong. James and I are probably the two biggest Die Hard fans in Empire. Helen is a big Die Hard fan as well.
Yep.
James and I quote Die Hard to each other on a daily basis. I don't even know where to begin with this story.
Well, do you know what? We're going to discuss Pan in a bit, and I feel like it's going to link up to this. Because here's the thing. Not everything in the world needs an origin. Not everything in the world needs a backstory.
Yeah.
Not everything in the world has to spring from some incident in your childhood. Maybe, much as I love Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, maybe this is all because of that fantastic train sequence where we see the origin of all of his stuff. But people now, instead of doing a little train sequence as a joke at the beginning of the movie, they're now doing an entire movie, or my God, trilogy of that train sequence. And that seems a little unnecessary.
It's not even that not everything needs an origin. It's almost certain that nothing needs an origin, because demystification ruins fiction. I mean, I won't dredge up the Star Wars prequels, but what I'm saying is to destroy Darth Vader, which is what those films essentially do, is a bad thing. John McClane is iconic to do this. You know, hey, Lynn Wiseman's made some good films, but have no illusions. This will be an absolute disaster. And also, frankly, it's completely missing the point. He's a regular guy. He's a standard cop. Yeah. He was the wrong guy in the wrong place at the wrong time. Watching him dole out parking tickets is not really
Except they won't do that. That's what a Die Hard prequel should be. It should be John McClane as a beat cop going around. Maybe the most he does is he busts a drug dealer. But they won't. You know they won't. You know he's going to get involved. There'll be some sort of terrorist incident that mysteriously wasn't mentioned in 1988 when he blunders in the Nakatomi Plaza. The first time he meets Hans and his team in the Nakatomi Plaza is the first time he sees a terrorist. And the whole point of Die Hard, someone on my Twitter feed again today said, Die Hard is John McClane's origin story. Die Hard is Die Hard Year One. Why do we need to go back? What's he going to do?
And he can't go rogue. He can't go maverick, because back then that wasn't him. He's a policeman. There are rules for policemen.
Yeah.
And he would behave perfectly normally. It's the worst thing in the world. It really is. If you were to go on the BBC right now, it will be the headline, The World is Ending, Die Hard prequel.
We should write it off. No film. It could be brilliant with the director of the fourth best Die Hard film at the helm. I'm sure it'll be in good hands. But Len Wiseman, when he tweeted that today, it was amazing. I watched the replies to his Die Hard Year One tweet, and I think there was maybe one person who thought it was a good idea. And it might have been his brother. Who knows? And maybe the level of negative reaction might make them think twice about this. Of course, the other problem is that Bruce Willis isn't getting any younger, and they need to start looking at rebooting, because it's got brand value and
honest,
you can exploit it for ages.
Didn't work out, so.
Didn't work out. Weirdly enough, I'd be happier, Jimbo, if they just bit the bullet and remade Die Hard.
Oh, God.
Honestly, I'd be okay with that.
Okay,
I would be.
Is a strong word.
No, I'd be still apocalyptically angry. But at least there's a basis there. It'd be hard to fuck that up. Although, they'd give it a damn good go, I'm sure. But we'd always have the original. But by going back and somehow trying to change things, and the amount of retconning that would go on, and the amount of stupid little Easter eggs and little glib references, and awful.
Thing is, Die Hard is the perfect film. There is nothing about that film I would change. I love every single frame of it. It is the best action film ever made. It is the reason the 80s exist. It's just, I can't emphasize enough the brilliance of that film.
So you're totally A-okay with the prequel, is what
you're
saying.
Yes, I'm already
we're fully on board, and we're prepared to give everything a chance. Right, there we go. I think it was... We're right there.
Yeah, he
wasn't
did
too
well.
Bad. Blood pressure all right. So it's time now for our guest this week. After the madness for the last few weeks, we had so many guests, we had to do two interviews a week and have specials galore. We've begun to settle down a bit. Time now to introduce a man who's been around since the late 80s when he exploded onto the scene as a teen idol in the likes of Pump Up the Volume and Heathers. He later went on to star in the likes of True Romance and, of course, who can forget Mindhunters. He's now starring in the acclaimed TV show Mr. Robot, which hits Amazon Prime this Friday.
Mm.
He is, of course, the great Christian Slater. He came into London recently and talked to Phil about a great many things, which is my way of saying Phil went on holiday without leaving any notes about what they talked about, and I have no idea because I haven't heard the interview, but I hope it's good. Please enjoy.
We are delighted. Christian Slater.
Hello.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you so much.
It's very, very good to have you along to talk about the show, Mr. Robot, which is terrific.
Oh, wow. It's unique.
It is unique.
Yeah, it has a unique quality to it.
It also feels almost from the get-go, almost from the pilot episode, that a show that's got legs.
Hmm.
Do you feel that?
You never know. I mean, you always hope for the best. You sign on to a show and, you know, meet with the team of people that are creating it. And, you know, so much of it comes down to the writer and how prepared he is and to continue to tell the story. And fortunately, in this situation, you know, Sam Esmail, the creator, started out this project with the idea of making a movie. But, you know, then he just started to write and write and write and write and write so much that it turned into like a 900-page script. And he thought, well, what can I do with this? And fortunately, there are all these platforms for him to be able to break up the story and tell it over a certain period of time.
We should put it in a little bit of context for our listeners. Mm-hmm. It's already in season two in the US. So if you watch it and you enjoy it,
right,
it's going and there's going to be more and
it's
more.
It's moving forward, yes. Yeah.
You play Mr. Robot, who right, is a kind of a little bit analogous to the Gene Hammond character in Enemy of the State. He is a mysterious, he's a great character.
Yeah, great character.
Mysterious kind of hacker behind a sort of techno-anarchist group.
Yeah, and a group called F Society.
F Society, and the F stands, of course, for
right,
the Fug Society, basically. And Rami Malek plays Elliot, who is a tech guy, basically.
Right.
It feels like there's sort of echoes of the Matrix in his Neo-like journey into this world with you as Morpheus.
Yes, no, there is certainly all of that. I picked up on that, too, when I read the pilot. And I certainly love those movies. I know Sam loves those movies. And he's a movie aficionado, and I think has collected data and picked up different ways of telling the story. I mean, this is also a Robin Hood-esque type of story. You know, as a creative guy, he's sort of borrowed and taken and used what he could do and the inspiration that he's gotten from things that he's seen, of course.
But
much like Rami Elliott's character in the show, I mean, there's definitely some specific moments where he makes references to movies and television shows and things that have inspired him as well.
The Hunger Games gets a bit of a kicking.
Yeah, the Hunger Games. The movie Hackers gets brought up a couple times. Pulp Fiction comes in.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know how many episodes you've seen.
I've seen a couple.
Okay, you've seen a couple. Yeah. So it's an interesting journey that Elliot Alderson goes on.
It does have those reference points, but it does, I have to stress, feel very fresh. And it has a different aesthetic from a lot of TV shows. And one thing that struck me is, it's an invidious term really, but zeitgeist. It does feel like it's tapping into something. And what does that term mean to you about in terms of something that's sort of current? There's a lot of anger about.
Well, when we made the pilot, a lot of things hadn't happened yet, you know, that had sort of brought the subject of hacking to the forefront and to everybody's level of awareness. A lot of those things hadn't happened yet, like the Sony hack. And I signed on to this just sort of thinking, well, this is a unique take on this particular world. I sat down with Sam, and like I said, he had mapped things out so well, and I had questions, and you know, he gave me better answers than I had anticipated or expected, and even went deeper into where the story was going to go. And that's when I really started to get very excited about it. And then, you know, we made the pilot, the Sony hack happened, this became a very relevant subject. And then the president's talking about it in the State of the Union address, and the China hack happens, and government employees' fingerprints are being stolen. And, you know, the scary thing is, it was great on the one hand for the show, but it's kind of scary to be living in a world where that is all actually happening and is possible.
It is a bit scary.
It is very scary.
The show sort of concludes that there's no such thing as privacy.
No, exactly. Yeah, our privacy has been robbed. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you're on Twitter, so you're embracing.
Yeah. All of this stuff, social media has become a force of nature. You know, it has just continued to grow, and, you know, it gets bigger and bigger every day, and Facebook gets bigger and bigger every day, and a lot of decisions are made on how many followers you have. You know, a lot of people are choosing actors who they want to work with based on, because if you have 5 to 6 million followers, I guess, you know, that's helpful in selling tickets and making money. It's part of, I think, what's happening with the industry. I mean, it's become that powerful of a force, and it's either you know, you can't beat it, so you sort of join it.
What happens if you have kind of imitation accounts? Fan accounts, does that count towards your
towards your
market cap?
No, I don't think so. I guess there's people you can hire that can delete those accounts and get those people that are following those false accounts moved into your actual account. That's how it works.
Okay, fair enough. So it seems like a show that's going to go and go. So Rami Malek was saying that you were kind of, this is nice. This is how it feels when something works.
Yes.
And you can appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah, no, look, after having experiences where, you know, you hope for the best, you know, things don't necessarily go the way you would ideally like them to go. It's always nice when people respond to something and appreciate it, and it's a great feeling. And when the pilot premiered and when they picked up the second season before the pilot even aired, it was phenomenal. You know, I mean, that just doesn't happen. And the fact that USA has been so supportive and really behind the show, I mean, these are all the elements that have to come together in order for something to work. You know, like something happens in the universe, and a creator like Sam Esmail has to come along, who is somebody who does tend to think out of the box and not put things in their safe cookie cutter sort of format. That's what people, I think, tend to respond to.
Absolutely. Can we go back to where it began, really? I mean, because you started acting when you were 8.
Yeah, when I was 8 or 9, something like that. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in New York and was doing theater and got discovered there. And for me, it was all like fun and games, really, and sort of a way to get out of school, which wasn't necessarily my favorite thing to do. It just wasn't, nothing really interested me in school, and I loved being in the world of the theater. When I was 5 years old, my father, he was an actor, and I used to go with him, you know, clinging to his leg, begging him to take me backstage. And it was an interesting experience to sit there and see him up on the stage and hear the audience laughing and reacting to what he was saying and thinking, wow, this is something that I would really enjoy. I've been doing it so long that there have been moments where I've been excited, I've been disillusioned, I've been disappointed, I've been elated. So I've run the whole gambit, really went through a process of, I think, rediscovery of what it is that I do love about this business. I mean, I do love to work, number one, and I love to immerse myself in another character and just put myself in the shoes of that person as much as I possibly can and inhabit the role and show up and be prepared and hit my mark and do the best I can.
It seems like, looking back on your career, that the Pump Up the Volume is the film. Is that fair? Okay. Or?
Well, it's definitely my favorite, I think, just on every level. I mean, that was, again, just a situation that came together very surprisingly, even for like the producers. They said that was like the easiest movie they've ever had to put together. It just, everything fell into place in a way. And again, the writer was great and really had a great story. And, you know, the nice thing about that movie is in a large way, it was pretty much ahead of its time. I mean, it kind of was like the first podcast.
I was going to say, yeah.
A guy sitting in his basement, you know, with a ham radio talking to nobody, he thought, but, you know, people started to tune in and listen. I had a guy come up to me recently at a party and just talking to me about that movie and the effect that it had on him and his life. You know, he was gay and in high school at the time and dealing with a lot of the struggles and issues that were broached in that movie. And what I liked about the Hard Harry character is that, you know, there was no stereotypical judgment from my character against what he wanted to do. It was more judgment of the people who were judging him for him being who he was and how difficult that was and just how frustrating that is to be in a society where people are made to feel uncomfortable for being who they are.
True Romance is kind of the beginning of Tarantino.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was the first script that he'd written, really. I mean, he made Reservoir Dogs first, but True Romance was the script that was in his nightstand table that, I don't know if Tony Scott pulled it out or how he got into his bedroom, I have no idea. Got a hold of that script and wanted to make it.
Heck of a movie, great script. Is it true that you and Tony took a little bit of time to kind of come together in accordance about the character of Clarence and that he gave you a copy of Taxi Driver to watch?
No, didn't give me a copy of Taxi Driver. There was no real, from what I recall, conflict or anything like that. No, we saw eye to eye and I loved him. I mean, he was just great and definitely a character all unto himself. Wonderful energy and phenomenal director and somebody that I miss greatly. And I always thought of him as a friend and certainly somebody I would have loved to have worked with again.
And it's just an amazing cast.
Yeah, it was. Phenomenal.
You must have been chuffed to see Patricia Arquette picking up the Oscar.
Yeah, that was amazing. And then the speech that she made and talking about equal pay for women and all valuable, vital subjects. Glad that she used the opportunity to talk about something that's unfair and should be dealt with.
Were you on set for the Sicilian scene?
No, actually, but that it was one of the first scenes that Tony actually shot for the movie and had spent so much time like putting it together. And I remember we were in Detroit. I was shooting a scene with Dennis Hopper and, you know, Tony had like a VHS copy of that scene and I think brought Patricia and I into the Winnebago to watch it and just said, you know, you got to see this. You got to see this, man. It's great. It's great. It's great. You'll love it. And we sat there and watched it and truly were blown away. I mean, Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper were phenomenal.
Do you go back and look at some of those old movies? Are you someone that, how do you feel about watching yourself on screen?
No. I tend not to look backwards. I tend to try and move forward as much as possible.
Yeah.
And if I do look back, it's, you know, briefly, maybe with a glimpse. And I don't know. I just keep moving forward.
It's a discussion point we had on a podcast recently about the era when you had songs. We call them pop busters.
Okay.
Songs that were attached to the movie.
Yeah.
In the case of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Bryan Adams.
Bryan Adams, yeah, sure.
And then you had one in Young Guns, which is Bon Jovi.
Yes.
So there were summers when, I guess, Christian, you would have been ubiquitous on big and small screens when they put those videos on VH1.
Right. The first movie I did, The Legend of Billie Jean, Pat Benatar had a great song, Invincible, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Great song. Legend of Billie Jean. And I remember we were definitely one of like the first music videos made at the time. I remember being 15 years old and MTV just really getting started. And it's so crazy. And that video coming on and just being so excited that I was actually in a music video. I couldn't believe it.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Did you call your mates up and say, you've got to watch, I'm on TV?
I've always been too shy to do that. If I had mates over, I might have like MTV on just by chance in the background, just in case. And maybe while we're playing with our G.I. Joes, it might come on.
How do you feel about Everything I Do For You?
The Bryan Adams song.
Yeah, it was number one in the charts here for about 6.5 years.
No, it's great. I mean, I love Bryan Adams, and that song was incredible. Another fun video, great experience. And look, I hear that song from time to time while I'm driving or in a mall or something, and it always makes me smile.
Brings back some memories.
Yes, yes, yes. It's very good.
It looked like it was a fun set to be on.
It was. It was incredible. We were actually shooting in Sherwood Forest and driving back and forth to London every night. And it was a phenomenal experience for a 16, 17-year-old kid, I think I was. Or maybe I was 20 then. I'm not exactly sure. But it was amazing.
Did you manage to pick up an Alan Rickman impression along the way? Or indeed a Sean Connery impression.
I wish I did.
In the Name of the Rose.
You know, Sean, he was like, just remember to breathe, boy. You know, that was it. That was the one bit of advice I got from him. I don't know. That was a horrible imitation, but the best I could do.
That was not bad. That was not bad.
Thank you.
Was it a bit intimidating to work with Sean, who was...
It was, a little bit.
He was renowned for being a little gruff at times, I think.
He could be tough with the crew at times if he didn't like how they were treating, like, the animals on the set or something like that. He would definitely take a stand. He's just... There's no question that Sean Connery is and always will be the best and just the biggest badass around. Every time I've seen him, he's always been amazing. And working with him couldn't have been a better foundation for me as like a young actor, just to see such a phenomenal example of dignity and grace and professionalism on and off set.
Yeah. You've had some great cameos down the years as well. Okay. As Christian Slater. I have to say, you make an absolutely terrific Christian Slater.
Thank you.
One I particularly love is Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Okay.
The battle over the caviar.
Yeah, that was amazing. You know, I'm a huge fan of that show, and Larry David and I bumped into each other, and I told him I was a huge fan of the show, and, you know, maybe a year later, I got a phone call from him, and it's just, he said, hey, you want to come and do this? And I said, sure, you know, I hate caviar, but I'll do it. That's how it happened.
Were you actually eating the caviar in the scene? Do you suffer for the art?
You'd think I would. I can't remember what they replaced it with, but it looked enough like caviar, like polenta or something, some little grainy thing. It was good, but ended up giving me dry mouth.
And Entourage, I think some people wanted to know what your grievance with Johnny Drama was, because you have one line.
I know it's
F Society, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. It really is. Yeah, that came together because I was shooting another one of these shows on the lot there, and they were shooting their show. They hadn't really thought about what they wanted to do, but threw me in there because I guess I just happened to be walking by. Yeah, I don't know if there'll be a sequel to the Entourage movie, but that is a question that could someday need to be answered. I don't know.
Zoolander 2 cameo?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, who knows? We'll see what happens there. Well, I guess they filmed that.
Yeah, there might be.
Zoolander, I would 3. Know, wouldn't I? I would know.
Unless you've been hypnotized.
No, absolutely not.
Austin Powers style.
That's right. I could have been drugged and kidnapped.
Yes. Christian Slater, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
There. That's good.
Thank you.
All right, mate. Thank you.
We had Happy Harry Hard on the podcast. That's very exciting.
We did.
Hard Harry, pump up the volume. You're looking at me incredibly blankly at this point.
No, I remember Pump Up the Volume.
Good, good.
Yeah, I mentioned it in the intro, but when you say the word hard on, it fills me with an existential dread.
Fair enough.
Okay, so what should you spend your hard-earned cash on at the multiplex this week? There's a lot of choice out there. We don't have a lot of time. Let's start with Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak.
Yes, this is Guillermo completely indulging his love of kind of gothic horror. Mia Wasikowska is his leading lady. She is Edith Cushing. No prizes for spotting the reference in her surname. And she is a plucky young would-be writer based in Buffalo, New York. All is well in her life. And one day she meets a tall, dark, and handsome stranger who is Sir Thomas Sharp, who is also Tom Hiddleston. He's come looking for money. He and his sister, who's played by Jessica Chastain, are trying to restore their family fortunes with the help of a new mining machine. And he's looking for investors in his grand plan. Edith's rich father says no. He doesn't trust this moneyed aristocrat, turns him down flat, and also orders him basically out of town. But he and Edith have already sparked a connection, and she ends up marrying him. Well, no prizes for guessing that that's maybe not the best idea she ever had. So they go back to the ancestral home in England, and it turns out to be the creepiest place in the world ever. The family fortune, you see, rests on this bright red clay. And this bright red clay, it's apparently wonderful for building, but what it does is it seeps up through the floor like blood. It drips down the walls like blood, and it looks incredibly creepy all of the time.
Yeah.
And then things start to get really worrying. There are ghosts, there are possibly psychos, there's all sorts of things going bump in the night, and all of it surrounded by enormously gothic design.
This is an interesting one, because we've been so inundated with sort of low-budget sort of Blumhouse horror films that it feels rather decadent to have a incredibly just sort of sumptuous, gorgeous-looking, beautiful, you know, Hollywood A-list, massive-budget horror film, except it's not really a horror film.
Yeah.
And I mean, Guillermo said this, he's basically called it a mystery, hasn't he, really?
It's a gothic romance, yeah. It's a mystery with supernatural overtones. There's a line in the film about it's not a ghost story, it's a story with ghosts in it.
Indeed.
And that's what this is.
And I think that line really kind of sums up my slight problem with the film, is that I found that it was a mystery without a compelling mystery, because he does a lot of telegraphing, but the telegraphing is so obvious. There's a house that bleeds. Do you know what I mean? You can see what's coming at every point. You know, there's nice little nods, a few lines here and there which resonate later in the story. But I think, you know, things like Jessica Chastain's character, who is so unbelievably malevolent. Do you know what I mean? It's like, do you think maybe she's not a good guy? I don't know. I'm getting strange vibes from her. Perhaps it's the way she's staring daggers at everyone and threatening to kill them. So that was a slightly odd one. But generally speaking, I enjoyed watching it. It's, I would say, the most beautiful film of the year, definitely. If it doesn't win some kind of production Oscar, I'm going to eat something.
Mm. Yeah, it is gorgeous.
It's amazing looking.
It also has the most enormous sleeves you will ever see in your life, which I think merits some mention. And Chastain looks absolutely incredible. I mean, yes, okay, sure, mega evil, but also like mega, mega hot. She looks absolutely fantastic. Hiddleston we haven't talked about, but like if you're looking for somebody to play a Byronic sort of hero / anti-hero / we don't quite know, he's got to be your guy.
Absolutely. He's very good in this, very, very dashing. We should mention he gets his Hiddle buns out.
He does.
Yeah. There's Hiddle buns all over the place. Absolutely.
Well, not all over the place. They're
firmly attached to the back of him.
He's not flashing them in every single scene, but they are there. I really like this. I mean, obviously, I should declare an interest. I was on set. I'm outrageously biased because I think Guillermo's fantastic. I thought this was great. Mm. It's not a horror film, and I think it's been it hasn't been missold. It's been sold as a horror film, obviously, because you've got to put bums in seats. A lot of people Hiddle bums in seats, and a lot of people are going to get into the film, and it's not the out-and-out shock fest. But there are ghosts in it. They are scary, but a common thread that runs throughout Guillermo's films, the ghosts aren't scary. It's the people who are scary. Yeah. And that is very much the case here as well.
Lots of his familiar kind of tropes are there. People meddling with clockwork is usually a bad sign, for example. There are a lot of those kind of familiar kind of elements. But he's never really indulged himself, I think, to this extent. And I'm not saying that as a bad thing. It's very much a good thing here.
Oh, absolutely. It's the most Guillermo del Toro film ever made.
It really, really is. And I thought it was interesting. It felt very stilted and very sort of artificial at the beginning to me. Like the language and some of the lines were a little bit sort of mannered. I mean, I think deliberately so. They were meant to be sort of 19th century sounding. Stick with that, because once you kind of get used to it after a few minutes, it does flow a lot more elegantly, and it does feel like it fits the film and fits the mood.
I think it's a beautifully painted canvas. I just don't think the story is perhaps as deftly told as I would have liked. I think if you'd sort of kept a lot of those reveals until sort of the third act, kept it until they'd actually got to where they were going, that would have made it sit better for me. Also, frankly, I've been to the north of England and it looks nothing like that. A very, very rosy view of what Cumbria looks like.
If you think that's a rosy view of what Cumbria looks like,
it looks like it's a bleak, the ground did bleed.
It's literally
it's a bleak,
rosy.
Desolate wasteland. Yeah. It doesn't come off well. Yeah, I will say very, very quickly, it looks beautiful. It sounds beautiful. It's very, very well acted. And it's a glorious fusion of so many influences. There's lots of gothic overtones. It's gothic romances, as Guillermo has said. There's Hammer in there. There's some great, you know, Dario Argento, Lamberto Bava references, all sorts of stuff going on. It's a feast for the eyes. So if you're going to go see it, why don't you bring your eyes with you? And we gave this 4 stars. Dan Jolin gave this 4 stars. So that's Crimson Peak. Next up, we have Joe Wright's Pan, which is an origin tale of Peter Pan.
Yeah, it's the origin tale that literally nobody asked for. That said, it's not completely terrible. So
again, the tagline.
Peter Pan is an orphan in London in the Blitz in World War II. You may be surprised by that, given that he meets the Darling kids in sort of 30 years before that. But let's not worry about that and assume that time flows differently in Neverland, namely backwards. Anyway, Pan is a boy with a destiny. It turns out that there is some funny business in his background that makes him the chosen one.
The Victorian count is way off the charts.
The Midichlorian count is totally stellar. He and his orphanage friends, who are ruled, by the way, by evil nuns, which is hilarious.
Played by the great Kathy Burke.
Indeed. Mm. Get abducted by bungee jumping pirates from Blackbeard's pirate ship, get taken to Neverland, where Blackbeard, who is the big bad, he oversees hundreds and thousands of Nirvana singing pirate miners who are looking for lumps of fairy dust to keep their ships flying and to keep Blackbeard himself young, even though Blackbeard also has a little bit of a death wish. He's kind of torn between wanting to live forever and wanting to be killed immediately. He seems a little bit conflicted. It's an interesting performance by Hugh Jackman. There in the mines, Pan, young Levi Miller, meets young Garrett Hedlund, who is the young James Hook. They try to escape. They meet Tiger Lily, who is from a native tribe that definitely has nothing to do with any specific culture in Earth at all. Yep. It's like there was an explosion in a circus that was also an anthropology shop. There's a lot of ribbons and pom-poms and not a lot of specific culture from anywhere. So don't worry about that, everybody. That's
which is how
fine.
They can get away with...
Which is how they can get away with all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And then they go on an adventure for... I mean, reasons to help the fairies of Neverland who have temporarily disappeared.
This is basically Bucks Fizz is a land of make-believe, but in song form.
It is absolutely demented. And like, it's also way too long for me. But every time I thought I'm completely lost, I am out of here mentally, obviously not physically, I wasn't going to leave the cinema, something gorgeous would happen. This is an absolutely beautiful film. You just said Crimson Peak is the most gorgeous film of the year, and that's probably true overall. But Pan has moments of just surpassing beauty. They find a new and interesting way to do mermaids. Who would have thought that there was still a new and interesting way to do mermaids? These flying galleons are gorgeous. The village is gorgeous. It's demented, but it's gorgeous. So I was able to cut it a little bit of slack in the end.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's all incidental detail for me.
Yeah.
The incidental details in this movie are great. So the mermaids are great. And there's a sequence later on when people get killed, they explode into puffs of colourful dust, which is...
It's basically a holy festival. Yeah, it's
great. Yeah, and that's really interesting. However, I found most of what goes around that to be quite... bad.
Yeah.
Having said that, to have a film and a filmmaker who swings for the fences and misses is a great thing and should be encouraged, and Joe Wright has really gone for it here. And introducing your bad guy, Blackbeard, played by Hugh Jackman, singing a Nirvana song in some sort of weird, timeless landscape that is obviously clearly a big green screen. That's interesting to me. And the first 10-15 minutes are really good. Actually, when it gets to Neverland, it goes off the rails a little bit for me. You know, it's still got enough to enjoy, I would say, which is why we gave it 3 stars. It's a recommendation. But it's already not done that well at the box office. It's probably one of the most shameless setups that I've seen for a long, long time. I'm not sure we're going to get it to see a Pan 2. Incidentally, very, very quickly, there's been a different version of this story every 12 years for the last few years. The Peter Pan, 2003, 12 years before this, before that. Hook was in 1991, 12 years before that.
That was my first premiere for Empire. The 12 years ago
Holy cow.
Yeah. It's the Book of Revelation again.
It is.
Holy cow. Very, very quickly, Helen, talk about the programme.
The programme, this is the Lance Armstrong drama. So we've had the documentary on it last year. This is the Stephen Frears film starring Ben Foster as the disgraced cyclist himself. It's a bit of a whistle-stop tour through his career, both before he got cancer, after he came back, basically using drugs throughout. I thought it was much, much better than the documentary of the same subject, because I think there Gibney got a little bit too close to his subject.
Okay.
This one has a little bit more distance. It focuses a bit more on Sunday Times journalist David Walsh, who was the first one to obviously ring the bell and say, hey, this dude is cheating. Good performances all around, but especially, I think, from Ben Foster, who is absolutely monstrous as Lance Armstrong in the very charismatic way that we see him, and also not in a sort of completely two-dimensional way. You do see the really good work he did with Live Strong and so on as well. So yeah, we give that 4 stars.
Does it include his dodgeball cameo?
It does not, sadly. And that is the big and the most awful outcome of the whole mess, is that he ruined his own cameo.
He really did. Never mind everything else. So there we go, the programme, and we gave that...
4 stars.
4 stars. 4 stars for the latest Stephen Frears film. Go check that one out if you would like. But I'm just going to very, very quickly talk about Super Bob, which Helen and James haven't seen. Super Bob is a low-budget British comedy about a British superhero. Stop, come back. It's much, much better than it sounds. Believe me, I had exactly the same reaction when I first heard about it. But this is a very, very funny, very sweet, very charming film that deserves your support. It stars and is co-written by Brett Goldstein, who's a British stand-up who plays Bob Kenner, who is a Peckham postman who gets struck by a meteorite, is imbued with Superman-like superpowers, becomes the world's only superhero. He works for the Ministry of Defence, and this film, rather than going down the tacky parody route or going down the obvious joke route, follows him on his day off as he prepares for a date. He hasn't had a date in years. He's quite shy and diffident and nervous. There's a lot of great jokes. There's a very caustic undertone which cuts through some of the more sentimental moments, but for me this is a really funny film, and it has a real heart to it as well. There's a gorgeous sequence towards the end, and it really does deserve your attention if you can find it in cinemas this weekend.
But who would win in a fight between him and Batman?
Hulk. We've established this, James. We've established this. 4 stars for Super Bob. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast, sponsored by Go Think Big, which helps you achieve your dream career through exciting work experience opportunities, valuable career advice, and exclusive tips. Find out more again by heading over to gothinkbig.co.uk. Next week, Join us for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Cary Fukunaga, the director of the forthcoming Netflix movie Beasts of No Nation. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Jimbo.
The end is nigh.
And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to write my pitch for Die Hard 6, in which everyone just forgets about Die Hard 6, goes home, has a nice cup of tea, and gets on with their lives. See you next week. Bye.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.